Western world. It is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating, but you tell me.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When Barry Maguire wrote and performed Eve of Destruction in 1965, the seeds of unrest had been sown on the campus of Ohio State University. Women's rights, civil rights, and the Vietnam War combined to trigger a campus backlash against the powers that be. Retired OSU Vice President for Business and Finance, William Shakerty, wrote about the era in his new book. It's entitled Ohio State University in the 60s, The Unraveling of the Old Order. He joins us now. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ann. Glad to be here.
The unraveling of the old order, meaning things changed kind of forever at that point. Was OSU a typical big university in how the era unfolded on the Columbus campus?
Not exactly. It was typical in the sense that it wasn't Berkeley. It was typical of the publics in the Midwest, at least at the beginning of the decade. As protests built, it was kind of more quiet than a lot of other places, particularly Michigan, Wisconsin, some of the more activist universities. In fact, that lasted till about the spring of 1970. And then the big confrontation between students and police and others occurred here on April 29th. I describe it in the book. And that was actually before Kent State and before even the Cambodian invasion was announced. And that was much more severe, not only than the other places in the Midwest, but worse than Berkeley, worse than Columbia, a lot of those others. So part of one of the questions the book tries to answer is how could a campus that seemed so peaceful and so quiet erupt in such a violent and sweeping way so quickly?
And you wrote that the hippie subculture took a while to catch on in Columbus. It quite a while, actually, as you said. I mean, when you look at the pictures of the kids on campus demonstrating through the 60s, that's not part of the picture, really. There's only a few with even longish hair at that point. So that was that Midwest. What was it about? Was it something about Columbus that was insulated?
I think the Midwest and the South tend to be more insulated than either coast.
Okay.
Or slower to pick up on change.
Anyway.
It kind of worked its way through the country.
But Michigan was different.
And then Central Ohio back then. Central Ohio now is very different than it was back then. And back then it was very conservative and even slower to change than the rest of the state. So you had that added on top of it. So it's kind of like the thing I compare it to is that great line in Macbeth about the witches, cauldron burn and cauldron bubble, double toil and trouble. There's kind of a mix that's starting to build pressure during the decade, and the university is very successful in clamping the lid down. In fact, they're so aggressive in doing it, it kind of lays the seeds so when the lid blew, it really blew.
Like a pressure cooker.
Right, and it blew more here than anywhere else.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Bill Shakerty. He's the author of a new book. It's entitled Ohio State University in the 60s, The Unraveling of the Old Order. This hour, we'd love to hear from people who are on the Ohio State campus in the 1960s to get your impressions of what we're talking about. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post a question or a comment there. You wrote, Bill, that technology and demographics conspired to bring a new order. The television was a big deal by 1960, and I'm sure I'd heard it before, but it's amazing how fast the spread of television was between 1950 and 1960.
Oh, absolutely. I think at the beginning of the 50s, TV was in less than a quarter of all households. By the end of 1960, it was in 90% of all households. And of course, then if something happened somewhere, it didn't happen instantaneously with satellites. I was just starting. But eventually, people elsewhere would see it. So there was a bit of influence in what was going on elsewhere. But the local factors still dominated, I would argue, in this environment.
And how so was that?
If you look at what happened at other universities, obviously, there was rebellion in the air in the last half of the 60s, but different universities responded differently. And what happened at Ohio State was much more severe than, say, what happened at Michigan, even though that was a large public institution with a long history of protest. So there were local factors involved that I get into in the, mm-hmm. in the book. And,
well, one of them was Navis G. Fawcett, right?
Correct.
The president from 1956 through 1972. He hung in there. Mm-hmm. He pretty much owned the era. And how do you summarize his influence at this time? What were his goals? What impact did he have?
He was an interesting figure, and I had a hard time getting my arms around him totally because different people had totally different perceptions. So a lot of the insiders spoke, and people who knew him best spoke very highly of him. In fact, he was hired because the trustees knew the university was headed towards a great expansion because of demographics with all the baby boomers coming. And he seemed to be a very capable manager in terms of the facilities part and the managing the money and the hiring the additional faculty and so forth. But there was a lot of criticism from student leaders who felt he was aloof. And although he was a very reserved man, I could see how that could happen. It's clear that even in other universities, for example, both Ohio University and Miami University of Ohio had young activist presidents who were out there meeting with students. And so when the riots occurred at OSU on April 29th, it wasn't as bad at those two institutions. Then after the Kent State shootings, that kind of overwhelmed things, and those institutions had to close down as well. So you can't say it was, if Navis Fawcett had done this or that, it would have been different. Obviously, he had an impact. Also, some of his lieutenants had an impact, and what I found interesting was almost a constant battle between hawks and doves about how to deal with student dissent. And to some degree, the fact that the hawks won initially helped make the dissent turn much worse than it would have been otherwise.
What about the demographics? You've made reference to the fact that they were prepping for this huge influx of baby boomer students. Mm-hmm. Huge. I mean, it was going to double the size of the university student body within just a few years.
Right. At the beginning of the decade, OSU's student population was a little over 20,000. By the end of the decade, by 1970, it was over 40,000. So you took a university the size of Ohio State in 1960 and built it on top of that existing institution. So naturally, you had pressures of growth, although that wasn't unique to OSU.
Was the fact that they were baby boomers, did they come with a different sensibility, too, to the university?
That's important. So, first of all, it was large numbers
and
all the pressures related to growth. But they also marched to a different tune. And they kind of felt that, their parents' generation was the greatest generation. And, they beat the Depression and they won World War II. But there were a lot of the ideals of America which were not fulfilled at home. And they felt a lot of them felt a certain sense of hypocrisy and felt obligated to do something about it. And so you had a combination both of numbers and a very different attitude. And that part makes the mix then of what occurred. And we had something then called the generation gap, that people that were born after World War II, which would be the students who started as freshmen in the fall of 64, looked at things differently than the people that did before. So you had older people in the administration, younger people as students, and so you had a very conflicting, differing views of the world and what was right and what was wrong.
When did you go to OSU?
I started in the fall of 64, so I was with the leading edge of baby boomers. I was born in 1946.
And that was after service?
No, that was before.
So you went here and then you served?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then you came back.
Right. And as I write in the book, I was stunned at how much the campus had changed in just those 3 years.
Like what?
Well, at the time I left, Vietnam was very much in everybody's mind. And because draft deferments had been abolished
and
for students.
You left to serve?
In the Army. I was going to
what
be drafted, so
oh, okay.
I enlisted in 1968
gotcha.
And ended up going 1969. Mm-hmm. By the time I came back in 1972, the war was a non-issue.
Mm-hmm.
And
very quickly became
yeah,
a non-issue.
Very quickly became a non-issue, except to some students. But most students seem more oriented to drugs, sex, and rock and roll than they were to any political case. Now, you always had some of that. It's a question of degree. But it's amazing how much the place changed from 64 to 68 and then from 68 to 72.
Is that why, I mean, what inspired you to want to write this book?
Well, I thought it was a great story that hadn't been told yet. One, which surprised me given how big and important OSU is. The other thing I noticed is that a lot of things have been written about other universities. And so there was a part of Buckeye pride that said, you know, we're not flyover country. What happened here is important. Mm-hmm. And it's particularly important because it was middle America. So it wasn't just a bunch of snotty rich kids at Harvard or Berkeley that were involved. It was middle class kids born and raised in Ohio who had a view that some things were different and needed to change. And I thought that needed some degree of telling.
I learned a lot from reading the book. And one of the things is a lot of people think it's sort of a recent events that have brought about the more selective nature of Ohio State, mm-hmm. the high GPAs, the high ACT scores, that kind of a thing. But questions and proposals about that date back to the 60s.
Oh, absolutely. And it's interesting. And people are critical of President Fawcett. I think he understood what was going on because he made a statement as he left that his job was to accommodate the big growth in student population, which the university physically at least did. But he said what was left undone is improving the quality of the student experience and the quality of the academics of the institution, which is what the institution did for the next 20 to 30 years. And it took a while for that to pay off. But if you take the long view, it's really a fascinating story. So on the one hand, you could be very critical of the administration for being out of touch with the new generation of students that came in the 60s. But once they had the big train wreck, they really worked hard at how to put Humpty Dumpty back together again and made some fundamental changes in the university that are still with us today.
Novice G. Fawcett as OSU president pops up a lot in the story because of the speaker's rule. Mm-hmm. Who got to speak on campus was an issue that they revisited many times over the course of the decade. What was it and how did it change?
Well, it originally came out of the paranoia about communism at the end of World War II and that Stalin and the communists were another Nazi Germany and they wanted to subvert American culture and were very hostile to free speech. So Ohio State and a lot of other places had a ban, required the university president to approve speakers under the argument that if it was someone who's a subversive that was advocating the violent overthrow of the government, that they shouldn't be allowed to speak on public land. And you could argue, I guess, in a near war paranoia of the Cold War, there's some truth to that. The problem is, how do you decide who's a subversive and who's not? And shouldn't public land be available to anybody who had something to say? And so that was the
free
conflict,
speech, blah, right. blah, blah, yeah.
And the thing I find is interesting is as the decade went on, I think President Fawcett realized that speaker's rule was becoming more of a problem than anything else, and he wanted to change it to get it off the agenda. But there were more conservative members of his board that were absolutely opposed to any change. And so that kind of ratcheted up the pressure.
Right. Anything like that had to go before the Board of Trustees.
No, it had to go to the president.
But
the Board of Trustees was looking over the president's shoulder.
Gotcha.
And what President Fawcett would argue is, hey, I've approved thousands of speakers of different opinions on this campus. What's the big deal? But the free speech advocates would argue that as long as you're banning one speaker or another, that isn't free speech. That isn't what a university is about. You ought to let people come and then let their ideas rise or fall on their own.
And just to let people know how conservative the Ohio State campus was at a certain point in the 60s, one of the most popular speakers of all was Barry Goldwater.
Oh, absolutely.
Before and after he lost his bid for the presidency.
And what a lot of people, one of the things I point out in the book is the perception is that everybody went from straight-laced conservative to flaming radicals overnight. In fact, campus opinion was much more nuanced than that. And you always had a pretty strong conservative minority, and they were in control at the beginning of the decade. Mm-hmm. By the middle of the decade, they weren't, and the more liberal students were more numerous and more active. But they were still very much involved all through the decade, and then in the 70s and 80s kind of came back again, but never came back to the strength they had at the beginning of the 60s.
We are talking about the decade of the 60s at Ohio State University. Lots of seeds were sown in that decade that didn't only affect students and the whole community at the time, but have played out over many, many years. My guest is Bill Schicchetti. He's author of a new book. It's entitled Ohio State University in the 60s, The Unraveling of the Old Order. If you attended Ohio State during the 60s and want to tell us about your experience, what you saw, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British Wars. A young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of engines.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. One-time Ohio State University student Phil Oakes wasn't in Columbus later in the 60s when students clashed with police over the Vietnam War and more. But when he released that song, Ain't Marchin' Anymore, in 1965, he still reflected the unrest that was building at OSU and on campuses across the nation in the 1960s. Retired OSU Vice President for Business and Finance, William Schicchetti, wrote about the era in his new book. It's entitled Ohio State University in the 60s, The Unraveling of the Old Order. If you were here in the 1960s and want to tell us about your experience, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You wrote that traditions fell like dominoes in the 1960s, mm-hmm. and a lot of them had to do with women and their rights on campus and off, for that matter. They were a thing pretty very early on in the 60s, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I start with the 1960-61 school year. And during that year, there was a big battle over the so-called apartment rule, where the university said if you were a single woman, you could not enter a man's apartment unless you were accompanied by a university-approved chaperone. And if you violated that, you'd get thrown out of school.
This is for women only.
For women only. A lot of these were for, you know, the theory was if we lock up the women, then the men can't get in trouble. But there's an incredibly paternalistic, unfair element to that.
There was a remark in some other part of the book where some kind of demonstration on High Street. This was pretty early in the 60s, 67 or something like that. And you said, well, of course, there weren't very many women because they had them all locked up
right.
by that point. That just kind of cracked me up. I mean, a lot of them were just male-oriented at first.
Yeah. And one of the interesting stories is that was one of the great revolutions of the 60s, how the university opened up much more to women at the end. And that was a more quiet revolution that was done led really by women banging on the existing system through the regular university processes. So it's kind of interesting. It's kind of going on all the time.
They controlled what everybody wore at things like dinner or lunch or something like that, but women more than men.
Yes.
Just literally what you could wear. Yes. I mean, it had to be like below zero or 20 below zero or something like that before you could wear pants.
Yes. That was, in fact, that controversy is dealt with in detail in the book, but that you were not allowed to wear pants to class or to other university functions unless the temperature was below a certain level.
I mean, a crazy level.
Yeah. You know, we look back at it now and think it was really silly, but people took it seriously back then.
What was the role of student government during this period, during the 60s? There was a lot of student apathy when it came to actually voting for their elected officials to represent them in the student senate.
Well, it was an issue of continuing contention throughout the decade. And normally you would have maybe 25% to 30% of the student body turning out to elect like the president of the student body, the president of the student senate, or the president of USG. So there's always a legitimacy issue. And I spend a great deal of time at the end of the book talking about the role of student government and the riots that occurred in the spring of 1970. There was a wonderful column written by Lou Heldman, who was a Lantern reporter at the time, and he said the the disturbances and the violence that spring really reflect poorly on the whole university, on trustees that were tone deaf, on an administration that was out of touch, on students that were apathetic, and a student government that wasn't assertive enough in trying to get things changed. And I kind of take some issue with that. I agree with him that the disturbances that occurred that spring were an institutional failure all the way around. But I think the student government leaders tried, but they just couldn't get students energized. And there were some differences. I spent a lot of time talking about the differences among students. They mm-hmm. weren't always in agreement
right.
as to what should happen either.
Well, Alan in Clintonville, you're on the air. You went to grad school there. You wanted to talk about the reverse protest.
Yeah, I went to grad school 69 to 71. We had a group of, as I recall, maybe five of us that were protesting the protesters. I don't think we really were against or for the Vietnam War, but it was we wanted to go to class. I've gotten out of the Army 2 years in the military, and we just wanted to go to class, and our, I chuckled at it, our claim to fame was that we got on the Phil Donahue show. Now, at that time, the Phil Donahue show was just out of Dayton, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
So a big claim to fame. But it
not
was
bad.
Mm-hmm.
Was there much of that, Bill Schicchetti, that Alan's describing?
Yeah. In fact, one of the things I talk about a lot in the book is who speaks for the so-called silent majority. The university administration would maintain that it was only 1% or 5%, pick your number, of the students that really wanted all this stuff. And that really frosted a lot of the activists who felt they had a lot more support. And in fact, there were a lot of scientific polling and referendums that occurred in that period that indicate a lot of students were kind of in the amorphous middle. And they didn't initially support the strike, but when the police started throwing tear gas into dormitories and fraternities, it was kind of like stirring up a beehive. And so part of this was a reaction against the police. Mm-hmm. But the strike leadership, in fact, did have support for a lot of the things that they were trying to get done, making university more open to black students, having university-paid daycare, and some of these things. So it was a kind of a mixed picture. So there were students. There were a lot of students who just wanted to go to class and not be bothered. There were others that wanted to go to class but supported the strike but didn't want people telling them they couldn't go to class.
Mm-hmm.
You had hardcore activists. You had hardcore conservatives. So it was an interesting mix of people that's what made that era so volatile.
Mike, or I should say Alan, thanks a lot for your call. Jack in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Jack.
Hi, boy, fascinating topic, and I'm really looking forward to reading your book. I have always been intrigued by the observations of David Horowitz, who writes about the time when the Weather Underground came to High Street. And it's a fascinating story. I was just wondering if in your book you look into some of the details of, I guess, what we might call student radicalism, the SDS, Weather Underground, and so forth, and their role on the Ohio State campus.
Yeah, good question. And mm-hmm. I do spend a lot of time on what the SDS was up to, because there was a chapter here that was an officially approved university organization, although they had trouble maintaining approval for a variety of reasons I go into in the book. What I conclude is that the SDS, by and large, was fairly ineffective here. That, in fact, they had tried to rally a student strike in the spring of 1968 and in the spring of 1969 and failed both times. And although SDS-related people are involved, they really don't play a major role. There's also an interesting, and I'd love to know the story behind it, but supposedly the SDS bomb maker, Kathleen Wilkerson, was spotted in Columbus the weekend that the disturbances occurred. The police claimed to have spotted her, but there's no other evidence of what she was doing here and why. So you did have some SDS underground activity here, but by and large, it was rendered ineffective and didn't have a lot of support.
Thank you, Jack, for that call. If anyone else has a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're talking about Ohio State University in the 60s. My guest is Bill Schicchetti. He is the author of a new book. It's entitled Ohio State University in the 60s, The Unraveling of the Old Order. You touched upon it a little bit, the issue of African-American students and race at Ohio State. You wrote that officially OSU practiced a policy of non-discrimination when it came to African-American students. What did that look like in the 1960s?
Well, it's interesting. You know, in the South, it was by law, black students couldn't attend white universities. In Ohio, black students attended and graduated here back to the 1880s. So on the surface, it looked like a very equitable situation. But in fact, a lot of practices were very hostile to African-American students. For example, and I have a lot of detail on this in the book, it was almost impossible for black students to find housing, either room in houses or apartments near campus, because landlords wouldn't rent to them. So you had a number of cases. In fact, Bob Duncan, who became very distinguished OSU graduate and federal judge, talked about how he had to take a bus from the east side of Columbus where he lived to campus because he couldn't live near campus. So he had to commute every day. Mm-hmm. You had, at that time, African-Americans were maybe 8 to 9% of Ohio's population, but they were only 2 to 3% of OSU students. They pretty much kept to themselves. They weren't, it wasn't a very welcoming situation.
Certainly sororities and fraternities, even though they were supposed to, they didn't. And the university let them continue practices of not allowing.
Well, that's interesting. You're absolutely right. And in fact, there were, I think, five black, all black fraternities and sororities, and then the rest of them were all white. Supposedly, fraternities and sororities were told to take discrimination clauses out of their constitutions as early as 1960 and were required to comply. And so they did, at least on paper, but they still didn't have any black students as members. And you had a big issue. The university maintained that that was a private organization. They shouldn't tell them what to do and that kind of thing. So you had a lot of back and forth during the whole decade. But I think on balance, it's safe to say that even though there wasn't legally sanctioned discrimination at Ohio State in the 60s, it was not a welcoming climate to black students.
And it was all sort of peace and quiet until the Civil Rights Movement kicked up.
Pretty much, yeah. And the Civil Rights Movement kind of crossed
Martin
the country.
Martin Luther King was assassinated, you know, that kind of a thing.
Well, even that, and I write a lot about the efforts on campus of both black and white students to support the Civil Rights Bill in 1964. And there's a wonderful picture in the book of students sending postcards, putting them into a campus mailbox to get Senator Lausche to vote for cloture so the bill could pass, which he eventually did. But it was very difficult to get the white student organizations to endorse doing that because they were afraid that even just supporting a peaceful demonstration that it would lead to violence. So there's a lot of, I think a lot of white students wanted to do the right thing, but we're not sure what that was.
Melanie in Columbus. Melanie, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. I understand Kaepernick is not standing for the national anthem, and I just wanted to say that in the early 70s at Ohio State University, many of us did not stand up. We just kept quietly seated during the national anthem. We were so angry about Vietnam and everybody being, our peers being killed in Vietnam. And that's all. I'll get off and listen to you on air.
Thank you, Melanie. That's an interesting note, though, because that's so much in the news these days, how we express ourselves when it comes to these national symbols, and in this case, the anthem.
And in both in the case of the way black students were treated and also in the Vietnam War, a lot of student activists felt, here we are, we've gone through the system. We've tried to change the system, and it's not responding. And so there was a lot of anger and frustration that kind of boiled over at the end of the decade.
Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I want to talk about another interesting thing that was going on in the late 60s and since that time at Ohio State. Ohio State was one of the early hotbeds of the LGBT rights movement. Ohio State had what was then the predecessor of Stonewall today, but it was a branch of the Gay Activist Alliance. And it was big enough that the FBI was actually had planted people and stuff who had come to meetings in the 60s because and up and through the 70s. They were afraid that in 72 there'd be another big thing at the convention, the Democratic Convention, and they didn't want a repeat of what had gone on in Chicago. And there are some interesting files I've got on PDF I could forward to anybody. But Ohio State was very proactive in that. John Quigley, Professor John Quigley from the law school, was our advisor. And that was pretty radical, difficult stuff to do back in the 60s, even though it's almost become passé today.
No, it's that's interesting. I'm glad you called, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I know the GLBT movement picked up some steam in the early 70s. I didn't realize how far back it got. The other thing that was interesting is there is evidence, and I talk about some of it in the book, of the Cincinnati office of the FBI doing dirty tricks and other things against SDS and some other student groups in that period.
Yeah, there is a question. It endures about whether or not an episode that took place on April 29th, well, actually, it was the big April 29th, 1970, at Neil and 11th Avenues. What happened there? You thought there was some monkey shines there as well with the FBI or the National Guard?
No. Well, everyone agrees that the spark that set off the what were called the riots occurred at Neil and 11th.
Okay.
And it started with a group of protesters, some students, maybe some non-students, supposedly closing the gate at Neil and 11th. Now, I've had people that I interviewed that were involved in the strike who claim they recognized, and people that were credible otherwise in what they told me that I could check out, that they saw undercover Highway Patrol people and Columbus police involved, both in closing the gate and in throwing rocks and bottles at police. The police, of course, have denied that. Hmm. They would never admit
it. I was going to ask if there's no public records or anything.
There is an interesting photograph that occurred in one of the students that was tried in a civil trial. William Kunstler ended up being his lawyer, and they put into evidence a photograph taken by the Highway Patrol that shows two people that are admitted by the Highway Patrol of being plainclothes officers with their hands on the gate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's clear they were there. What is not clear from the picture is whether they're opening the gate or trying to close it. Highway Patrol was called in after the gate was closed, and I go into detail in the book about this. They were called to try to open it because this was supposedly a route for emergency vehicles to the emergency room. And in the opening or closing of the gate or clearing of the street, there was witnesses from both sides tell me it got very physical with Highway Patrol plainclothes people and protesters pushing and shoving and kicking, trying to get arrested. So then the undercover or the plainclothes people, I'm sorry, there's a difference between plainclothes and undercover. The plainclothes officers, of which there are about 10, called for backup from the Highway Patrol. So about 100 Highway Patrol in uniform, but not in riot gear, showed up next and tried to get the situation under control. They couldn't, and so they called on the Columbus Police D platoon, who came in and was firing tear gas, and then that
the infamous D platoon,
right? The infamous D platoon,
which we will talk about more. I want to get into how the police responded,
right,
going back to the earlier 60s. With my guest, he's written a book about Ohio State University in the 60s. Bill Shakurdy, author of Ohio State University in the 60s: The Unraveling of the Old Order. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. By the 1970s, when Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young released the iconic Ohio, memorializing the death of four students at the hands of National Guardsmen on the Kent State University campus, the decade of the 1960s was technically over, but the changes were felt very, very deeply then and today. Retired OSU Vice President for Business and Finance William Shakerty wrote about the era in his new book entitled Ohio State University in the 60s, The Unraveling of the Old Order. He's with me today. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk about the relationship between the students and the police. There were some silly little incidents, it seemed, that came up early on that started to sow seeds of discord early on, before the war was a thing, before much of anything was a thing. Tell us about those.
Okay. Well, the one that a lot of people can point to are the so-called jaywalking riots in early 1964, where the Columbus police were very strict in enforcing jaywalking rules and give out tickets quite readily to students and others. And they came, and a lot of times students would blow it off and not pay the tickets. So they decided to make an example out of someone and showed up at a sorority house, and there was a woman who had a ticket and didn't pay it, so they took her downtown. And it turns out it's almost a comedy of errors if it wasn't so serious, although no one was hurt in all this. But it ended up erupting in a protest that by later 60s standard was fairly benign. There was three or four students, I think, were disciplined, and some property was damaged, and students marched around a lot, but there really wasn't a lot of done. But it kind of sowed the seeds. And then as the 60s went on, you had a big increase in crime on campus, and there were a number of very lurid public murder cases near campus, not on campus, that were never solved. And so the students started saying, you know, the police are here ticketing us for jaywalking, but they can't seem to solve these murders. So that kind of contributed to the atmosphere. And then you also had, as the decade wore on and protests got more violent, the police became more assertive in dealing with them. And I think the turning point, and I was on High Street that night when it happened, when the D platoon made an appearance on campus for the first time. Now, the students were convinced, and I was one of them, that D platoon was set up specifically to deal with campus riots. The police didn't wear any identifying badges or anything. Right. And we thought it was sure that the city was out to get us, is what it was about. It turns out I've had credible explanations. Why is there a D platoon? Well, A, B, and C platoons are the regular 8-hour shifts. D platoon was the swing shift that anytime there was extra trouble,
but
they
why
could
no identification?
What the police claimed is that that made it harder for snipers and that kind of thing, which is really hard to believe. But that was the explanation. But that sowed a lot of distrust. So beginning with the deployment of D platoon during the strike of university employees, and that ended up a lot of students and police got into it, and there are a number of arrests. There was, in fact, a student that succeeded in winning a court judgment against the police for excessive force. And so as the decade got more contentious, the relationship between the police and the students got contentious. There was a wonderful survey that the city of Columbus did after the 1970 riots, asking students what they thought of the police. Do you think the police are your friends? Of the white students, 30% said yes, 70% said no. Of black students, 0% said yes, and 90% said no. Then when they asked the police what they thought of all this, the police felt that they were stuck in the middle in what was essentially a conflict between the students and the university. So everybody had kind of a different view on it. But I think it's pretty clear that particularly in that April 29th disturbance, that a overreaction by safety forces, particularly in their use of tear gas, and some of them admitted it later, precipitated in getting the fence sitters and less committed students stirred up, which added then to the behavior which resulted in a lot of injuries to both students and officers. Fortunately, no one was killed here, which is another interesting story in its own. But you had a very interesting and difficult relationship between the city police, and the students, both for students and for the black community, and all that kind of came together in the spring of 1970.
Don in Delaware County, you're on the air. Hi, Don.
Yeah, what your guest described is exactly what I saw, because I was a graduate student in entomology at the B&Z building at 1735 Neal Avenue. And I was sitting in the lounge there, and I heard some pop, pop, pop. And then all of a sudden, there's a number of people, many people running. And that's where it all started. That was 11th Avenue. That's what he described. And it was Deep Platoon as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and the other thing that I would say is that I think the overreaction with tear gas, because that was at the point in time when people were starting to take exams. And I think, as he said as well, that they recruited a lot of the students primarily because they got tear gassed and they got mad. And that's just simple as that. So it was overreaction with the police, and they didn't know how to deal with these things. And that's exactly what I'd say. The other thing I'd add is that I lost about 8 months' worth of research because I couldn't get back on the campus for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I still do remember that. And I was at that ground zero right there.
Yeah.
I remember seeing the people running down the road, and I thought, and you could smell tear gas.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Don.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Take care. Gail in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I went to Ohio State from 68 to 72, and the women's studies and the black studies department, I remember going to rallies on the Oval, and I think because of the power that the students were starting to feel because of demonstrating against the Vietnam War, first there were huge rallies on the Oval to get a black studies department started, and also women's studies. And one other thing is because sort of in relation to you were talking about the constrictions put on women students.
Mm-hmm.
I remember some of the first women's marches. It was called Take Back the Night marches because of, you know, of the restrictions that were put on women, and you know, and harassment by some guys, you know, because the women's studies movement was coming into the department was coming into being, and we were getting harassed by a lot of men. Also, one quick question I wanted to ask your guest is, when I was, as I say, I was there through 72, and I'm not sure if it was 69 or 70, but when after the shootings at Kent State, there were a lot of riots and tear gas on the Oval. And one time I was staying in an apartment on 11th, and I swear to God, I saw tanks rolling down High Street. Tanks. And I'm not sure if that was, I don't think it was, I think it was the National Guard. I don't think it was the police. So I'm curious, who authorized the use of tanks? Was it Fawcett or was it Rhodes?
Okay. Well, to me, being a former military person, tank means a very specific thing. I think what you're referring to, the National Guard units that were called to Ohio State were not what are called armored units that are equipped with tanks. I think what you're referring to are what are called armored personnel carriers, which are these boxy things on treads which are used to
– Okay.
To I'm not aware of any cases, and I haven't seen any – I've seen a lot of pictures. I haven't seen any of tanks.
Uh-huh.
I have seen –
with the big guns on them.
Right.
Yeah.
But I have seen armored personnel carriers. Okay. The National Guard was brought in the first time – at the request of President Fawcett, requested it of Governor Rhodes because the Columbus police and the university police, which weren't a factor then in the highway patrol, were having trouble keeping the riding and stuff on campus. There's a whole interesting story in the book. I got to interview the gentleman who's Colonel Abrahams, later became a general, who commanded the 1st National Guard unit that came to Ohio State, and what his orders were and how he interpreted those. And it's a fascinating story. And he and they deserve some of the credit for an outcome here that was different than it was at Kent State, even though it was Ohio National Guard. So by and large, the National Guard would be requested by the university, and then they'd be brought on, requested to the governor and then brought onto the campus. The National Guard and the police also changed their tactics from the time the university closed to when it reopened. So it closed on May 7th. It reopened on something like May 21st, about 14 days later.
Gail, thanks for your call. Was it closed after Kent State?
Yes.
Okay.
So After the April 29th fracas that I talked about, there were two really bad days on campus, which would have been that occurred Wednesday afternoon and Thursday during the day. That's when you had the National Guard chasing students across the Oval and everything else. By the weekend, a lot of students went home and the air kind of campus settled down. And then at noon on Monday, May 4th, the strike resumed here, but it was fairly laid back. Then the shootings occurred at Kent State, and then that stirred everything up again, and that's when the university had to close. And then when it reopened 2 weeks later, they changed their tactics. Instead of, they realized they'd been overusing tear gas, so instead they put more boots on the ground and used the National Guard to cordon off the campus so you could keep the outside troublemakers out and still let the students in. And they were much more permissive about allowing the students to protest as long as it didn't turn into destruction. So it was a whole different strategy. But there were still some confrontations. I go into it in the book after that period as well. So it was a very tense period.
Gail, thank you for your call. I want to turn now to John in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, John. You went to the commencement in 1969.
Yeah, that's right. Hello. Thanks. I'm enjoying your discussion. You were talking about the evolution of OSU's political orientation from conservative to liberal in the 60s. I remember going to my sister's commencement in the spring of 69, and I was sitting in the horseshoe with my parents as we listened to Spiro Agnew give the commencement address, and Bob Hope was awarded an honorary degree.
Right.
And they were trying.
As I recall, they were very well received as late as 1969.
That's right.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because that when I read about that, it captured my fancy because it showed, at least through the spring of 1969, how calm OSU was. And in fact, President Nixon wanted to come here to deliver the commencement address. That's how safe they thought it was. Huh. But he ended up having to meet with President Tu at Midway Island to start the Vietnamization. So he sent Vice President Agnew. And Agnew tried to do a more statesmanlike address. But I have a quote in the book about him kind of trashing demonstrators and administrators for being weak-kneed and stuff.
Yeah.
And there were a couple of students that got up and protested, but by and large, he was greeted warmly. Yet a year later, the situation was so chaotic here that they had to close the campus down. So one of the questions the book tries to answer is how in a period of 12 months could OSU have gone, the wheels come off so quickly? And what I argue is that it really is pressures that had built up for 10 years.
Thank you, John, for that call. I got time for one more, and that's Marilyn in Arlington. You're on the air. Hi, Marilyn. Hello, Marilyn. All right. Well, that's about it then. Let's talk about the media. We only have a few minutes left, but the media played an interesting role during the course of the 1960s. There was the Lantern, of course, the student newspaper, and two city newspapers, the Evening Dispatch and the Citizen Journal, right? So how did they respond to all of this? What did you learn in general from reading the newspapers?
Well, differently. The Lantern, of course, was done by students, so they tended to be very sympathetic to students, and throughout the period tended to be more liberal. Not always, because the people would joke that the Lantern editorial board would change every quarter and the Lantern editorial position would change every quarter, sometimes in the same editorial. But by and large, the Lantern was very supportive of students. The Columbus Dispatch was one of them at that time, one of the most conservative newspapers in the country and didn't like student protests of any kind. So they were out there kind of beaten on the protesters. The Columbus Citizen Journal was regarded as a little more liberal than the Dispatch, but still somewhat conservative. And then the other player, which is fascinating to me, was the monthly alumni magazine.
Yeah.
And the alumni secretary, Jack Fullen, was a former Lantern editor and reporter, and they were not afraid to take a stand on controversial issues and sometimes would get into it with President Fawcett. And there was a big uproar when OSU did not go to the Rose Bowl in 1961 that pitted the head of the alumni magazine, Jack Fullen, against Coach Hayes. And that thing is written about in the book. It's a fascinating.
How times have changed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bill Schickerty, thank you so much for joining us today. We're out of time, but still plenty more to talk about, and I appreciate you starting the conversation.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's William Shakerty. He is the author of a new book. It's entitled Ohio State University in the 60s, The Unraveling of the Old Order. Thanks to all to the listeners for the great calls. Appreciate your input as well. It's a nice living history moment for those of us here at WOSU. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All Sides interns Walter Hopp, Jessica Shakespeare, and Jess Shelby Powers, with video production by Rich Karzmitsky and Amber Karzmitsky. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.